Welcome to the Two Pages of Mystery podcast, now part of the Coil Entertainment Network. I'm your host, Rob Steele. If you'd like to become a published author with us, stay tuned after the show for a vast majority of the details. Let's get right to this week's story. This week, no Lieutenant Cooper Wright, but the same department. This time we get the night shift and Detective Calvin Glenn, who pulls a strange case involving tattoos, vampires, and a big hairy guy named Samson. And for a special treat, the part of Calvin Glenn will be played by a new addition to the Two Pages family, John Sitzman. So sit back, relax, and prepare yourself for Obsidian Sky.
Night shift is always pretty weird. People have this instinct that says they can get away with more at night. Just because we can't see you as well, that don't mean we can't see you at all. That's what detectives are for. We see what the normal person can't, or doesn't want to. Now, I don't mind it weird. I've been on night shift so long, nothing really surprised me anymore. I'm not jaded, I just don't get as surprised as I used to. Still weird, though. I've enjoyed the past several years in homicide. Solving cases, locking away the bad guys, give you a good feeling. Despite what the current administration might tell you, crime is down. And that's a good thing. That's why I'm riding a desk tonight. It's a Murphy's Law thing. If I start patrolling randomly, end up on the east side, something gonna happen on the west side. Mama Glenn always said, Calvin, you don't go looking for trouble. Of course, I became a homicide detective and looking for trouble is my job. I just don't go looking unnecessarily. I know I'm gonna get a call soon. Sure enough, about an hour into the shift, I'm called by Officer Scott Walker. He wants me to join him at a crime scene he'd been called to. Woman was bound, forced to watch her husband killed. As I head out, I notice the moon is full. That makes this shift all the weirder. Mama always said the full moon, did things to people. When I arrive at the scene, it's not what I'd expect. Small house in the suburbs on the south side of town, wide picket fence and everything. It's also well lit by streetlights. That usually deters the common criminal. But this one, anything but common. I joined Walker on the porch of the house, and he filled me in on what transpired.
The victim's name is Rory McDougal, age 34. Until recently, he was an accountant, but he lost his job when his firm downsized. His wife, Lindsay, said they'd just gotten home from a party at a friend's house when Rory was struck from behind. Says she was so startled she didn't even defend herself, and she was struck from behind, too. Says she came to in the kitchen with her hands bound behind her in a zip tie. She was also blindfolded with a, I guess this is canvas, maybe burlap, whatever. Lab guys can tell us more. Anyway, she says that it slipped a bit and she saw a small person in a black cloak leaning over her husband and, get this, sir, eating away at his neck. Neighbors heard her scream, called 911, and came over and found her and her husband. Nothing they could do for him, though. His neck was pretty much gone. He bled out in the kitchen. She was covered in it, too. They took her to the hospital to get checked out. We had a blood trail, but it fades out pretty quick. I put in a call to the canine unit, but they'll be a while. Something about a surprise inspection. You'd think they'd be more interested in seeing the hounds work than testing them for rabies again.
I thank Officer Walker and move inside. There is a series of bloody footprints running across the living room carpet from the door to the kitchen. Also, two sets of bloody wheel tracks where they wheeled out the victim and his wife. One set of footprints stand out, though, considerably smaller than the other prints and with a pattern I'll recognize. It's the pattern the CSIs use at crime scenes. They wear paper shoes over their regular ones so they don't contaminate the scene. I noticed one of the CSIs, think his name Davis, getting photographs of all the footprints. I do a brief check of the kitchen, but I don't stay long. I know I said nothing really surprised me anymore, but the amount of blood and ripped skin is still disturbing. How could someone do this to another human being? There seemed to be no sign of a murder weapon. Davis say CSI didn't find one either, and all the knives in the kitchen seems to be accounted for. It's a nice house. Carpet looks new, apart from the blood. There's a TV, several books on a shelf, couch, love seat. Nothing seems to be missing. That usually means we can rule out robbery gone wrong. Walker said the victim was unemployed, so probably nothing job-related. Why would someone eat his throat, though? Sound like a vampire, but it's March. Halloween months away. My phone rings. It's the coroner, Gabrielle Rosenberger. Connection's a bit staticky, so I take the call outside.
Hey, Calvin. I've done the preliminary on your Vic, Rory McDougal. He was worked over pretty good. Not a whole lot of blood left in his system, but judging from the scene photos Davis sent me, there's a lot of blood missing. There's a pretty good bump on the back of his head from where he got hit. I heard from the hospital that Miss McDougal has a matching knock, so there's some consistency. Looks like a lead pipe did that. As for your murder weapon, I hesitate to say this, but it looks like teeth ripped his neck out. But that brings me to the good news. Well, as good as you can get with three dead guys.
Tree? Okay, that surprised me. What do you mean, tree?
I was talking with Song Ho, the day shift coroner, and he was talking about two others that had the same M.O. I pulled their files. Miss Sorley Allen and Mr. Greg Monroe. Sorley was a cook. Greg was a pilot. She was married, he wasn't. She was black, he was Asian. The only thing Doc Young was able to connect them with were death by exsanguination from a neck wound, time of death, which was about a month apart during a full moon, and their new tattoos. Our new guy, Mr. McDougal, has a new tat also. All the tattoos are different. Mr. McDougal's is a... Well, I don't know what this is. I'll send a pic to your phone.
Shortly, my phone received a picture of the tattoo, and frankly, I have no idea what this is either. Rosenberger sends the address of the tattoo parlor, Obsidian Sky, where Allen and Monroe got their new artwork. It's a lead that seems a bit too easy. Why would a tattoo artist kill the people he or she just inked? The Obsidian Sky is downtown, and as a pleasant surprise, two in one night, it's still open. The proprietor is a Vivian Lowe. I'm welcomed into the shop by a small and visually out of place receptionist named Ebony Wind. Rather obviously an alias, but I don't push it. Once I introduce myself, she asks me to wait for a moment as she asks for permission for me to come back and see Ms. Lowe. She say client privacy is very important. Behind the reception desk is a hallway with four doors. She opened the first and asks if it's okay. Soon she leads me to the room where Ms. Lowe is working on a very elaborate tattoo on a large and very hairy man's back. Wouldn't it be easier to shave his back first? I quip. No one touches my hair, the large man rumbled, although he didn't move.
Good, you're learning,
said Ms. Lowe, admiring that. Where Ebony Wind looked waifish and, if anything, so fairy-like that she seemed out of place, Miss Lowe was so dominatrix that she fit the tattoo parlor almost too well.
It's so hard to get people to understand that if they move, I'm going to stab them in a way they don't like. Incidentally, yes, it would be easier without the hair.
No one touches, he began to repeat, this time rising from his prone position on the table.
Sit down, Samson,
Miss Lowe admonished.
Regardless, Ebony said you were needing some information. I really hope another of our clients wasn't murdered. That detective, what was his name? Vasquez. Yes, he was nice, if a little slow. He told me about Greg and Sorley. That was a terrible shame. Don't tell me you have another.
I'm afraid I do. Rory McDougal. Can you tell me anything about him? For example, what is this? I show her the picture of the tattoo on my phone. She snickered, which seemed a bit out of character for her dominatrix persona.
Poor Rory. He got this just last night, you know. And that poor tattoo. I can't explain why he wanted that. It's just a snake over the Batman logo. I think it might be the worst tattoo I've ever done, but it's exactly what he wanted. Didn't say why.
Was there anyone else here when this got done?
No, just Ebony and myself. Same with the others as well. I know that's a horrible coincidence, but that's just what it has to be. You say Rory was killed tonight? We've been here working on Samson since Bound 7. I know alibiing each other isn't the greatest, but we do have a camera on the front and back door. You're welcome to the footage.
She gestures to a computer server in the corner of the room with a monitor showing both doors.
If I'm doing a tat this late, I like to work in here since I can see the monitors in both doors.
I appreciate that, ma'am. I would like a copy of that footage. Like Mama Glenn always says, it's good to be thorough.
A wise woman, to be sure.
She opens a drawer under the tattoo table, pulls out a USB thumb drive, plugs it into the server. Called into the monitor, copies three files to that drive. A minute later, she hands it to me.
I put the footage from today and past two on here as well. Records of who was getting ink. And keep the drive. It's promotional.
I thank Miss Lowe for her assistance and head back to the CSI lab. I know it technically isn't protocol for a suspect to get the footage like that, but I know Detective Manny Vasquez. And if he's already checked her out, I'll have a feeling she good. That's part of Manny's charm. He seems slow sometime, but that lulls people off guard. He's really good with that. Now, if we could just get his facial hair under control. Working the lab tonight is Daryl Silverstone. He used to work for a cruise line as an IT guy till Cooper Wright recruited him to work for us. That was a great catch because Daryl really know his stuff. Another one? Man, he just brought me one of these about a month ago. Well, another victim with a connection. Let's see what we got. He plugs the drive into his laptop, checks it for viruses and malware. Why are you looking at me like that? Just because I talk Cajun doesn't mean I don't know what software is. And just because the drive from Manny was clean, that doesn't mean this one is. And it's always a good idea when you get a drive and don't know where it's been. We do a quick scan, tonight's video footage, and sure enough, there's Ebony Ward, Vivian Lowe, Samson. That's a pretty solid alibi for tonight's event. But just to be sure, we checked the other files as well. Last night footage shows something very interesting. Mr. McDougal was on the footage, of course. He looks quite drunk, but is sober enough to sign the forms and get a tattoo. He's shown walking to the back, but we lose him there. Ebony's at the front desk when a small woman come in, hangs a cloak on a hook near the door. Footage is black and white, and Daryl said that saves space on the hard drive. But that cloak, that looks black to me. Short, with a black cloak. Sounds like we have a person of interest. I place a call to the Obsidian Sky, and thankfully, Miss Wind is still there. Answer the phone. I hear a mumble grunt in the background and a buzzing. Sound like Samson's still getting his ink worked on. I glance at my watch. They start at 7, and it's almost fall. That's a hell of a tattoo the man's getting. Wonder if anybody be able to see it under the forest of hair on his back. I ask Miss Wind about the woman with the cloak, and she immediately apologizes.
Oh, my God, we forgot. She's here so much.
The background buzzing stops, and I hear Miss Lowe take the phone.
Detective Glenn, I presume? I apologize for Miss Wynn's conduct. She's usually much better behaved than to yell into the phone like that. What is the matter with you?
I hear her berate her receptionist.
What is the matter with you? What do you mean? Oh, dear, Detective,
she says, changing the object of a voice.
There was someone else here. I do apologize for our behavior on this occasion. She is here so often and so quiet that we don't think about her being here.
My patience is running a little thin from all the exposition, but I manage a fairly civil, who?
Oh, my apologies again. Jezzy. She says she's an aspiring tattoo artist. She comes into the shop several times a week and just watches. Rarely says everything, so we usually forget she's there. But if I think about it, I think she might have been there the night Greg and Sorley got their ink, too.
Well, do you have a name? Maybe an address? Ms. Lowe supplies us with the name Jezebel Sky. Like the shop, but with an E on the end. She say that's why she chose this parlor for her observation. Ms. Lowe describes her as a little dark and gothic, but a fairly nice young girl. Lives in an apartment not too far from the shop. I contact dispatch and have them send two squad cars to that address. I don't want to take any chances. She may be small, but if she is who we're looking for, she found a way to kill three people at least, and that is never a good thing. After obtaining a search warrant, which Judge Castillo signed without hesitation, I join the officers. We enter the two-story apartment building, make our way to the suspect's apartment, Bravo 6. Outside, we see a lead pipe leaning against the door frame. One end looks coated in blood that's run onto the hallway carpet. Young couple enters the hall from the stairs at the other end. We try to wave them off, but one just can't resist talking to us
rather drunkenly. What you going after Jessie for? She's such a cute young thing. I try to wave him on down the hall, but the young'un just won't shut up. Hey, she's an artist, you know. She paints cool stuff. Like that pipe. Looks like real blood, doesn't it? His girlfriend mumbles apology and pulls him down the hall. They go into apartment B3. I knock on the door, rather loudly exclaim, "Miss Sky, police, we have a warrant." After waiting a few heartbeats for a reply, I motion one of the officers to open the door. He tries the knob first, and to our surprise, it opens. Three surprises in one night, last time I ever claimed to never be surprised. The apartment's almost as I'd expected it from the description by her drunken neighbor. Rather small and plain, but covered in half-painted canvases, paint tubes, bottles. In one corner of the room is a mattress with a small figure on it. Telling her not to move seems a bit redundant, but I do it anyway as we enter the room. One of the officers turns on the light, revealing a bit more than we'd expected. The figure on the bed is Miss Sky, and she's covered in blood. Beside her, a tree mason jars of blood and an assortment of pills. Looks like we found our killer, but the pills and her unresponsiveness certainly don't make this feel like a win. Rest of the night is spent getting care for Miss Sky. First, ambulance to get her to the hospital, then the CSIs gather the pills, the blood for analysis. The blood, as it turns out, does belong to our victims. We didn't find any phlebotomist equipment, but that don't necessarily mean anything. Could have been disposed of anywhere along her route. The pills, now that's a different story. They were prescription medication for a delusional disorder I can't even pronounce. We track back, find they were prescribed by Dr. Griffith Marcus, psychiatrist. We explain the situation, and he tells us a story about a young artist woman who had delusions about being a vampire. Although he also says that may not be the case here, and that he'd provide more information about Miss Sky, but the doctor-patient confidentiality thing applies to this case. Not the happiest ending to this case, but as Mama Glenn always used to say, any ending you walk away from is better than one you don't.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this week's story. If you'd like to become a published author, that's the purpose of this program. It's hard to get published unless you've been published, so what we do here is we take your short story, publish it first as an ebook on the website, then we turn it into an audiobook for the podcast, and when we've got enough stories, we'll turn it into an actual book that you can buy at an actual store. Then you'll have something to put on your resume that says, "I've been published, so publish my bigger works." If you'd like to submit a story to us, email it to contact@twopagesproject.com. That's right, Two Pages Project, because technically, this is the last episode of Two Pages of Mystery. Next week, this show becomes The Two Pages Project. We will be open to any kind of story you want to send us. Not just mystery anymore, but sci-fi, fantasy, historical fiction, western, melodrama, whatever you want to write. Just submit your story for an audiobook treatment and publishing on our website. Don't forget to use that new email address, contact@twopagesproject.com. Don't forget to pass the word around about the show because it's free and it's fun. There are a few rules, but those are listed on the website. They're very easy. The new website, however, is twopagesproject.com. It's still the number 2. Pages Project still uses letters, so go check that out. We'd like to thank iTunes, the Google Play Store, and the Happy Hour Network for passing the show along. Don't forget to follow all the Coil shows on the Pinterest and YouTube channels. And we'd like to thank John Sitzman again for playing the lead in today's story. If you're interested in being part of the audiobook process, use that same email address, contact@twopagesproject.com. So, until next week, be safe and keep writing.